Coming up on Equity, we'll break down Uber's huge week of news for you, and then one of Silicon Valley's top corporate lawyers, who works with Airbnb and GitHub, tells us what's in store for IPOs, what he thinks of ICOs, and the mistakes he thinks startups are making about corporate governance. Welcome to Equity. I'm TechCrunch's Katie Roof, joined by my colleague Matthew Lindley.
Hello.
Crunchbase News Editor-in-Chief Alex Wilhelm.
Hey, guys.
And we'll bring on our guests later on. But first, we wanted to talk about Uber because it was a really big week. So we're going to recap a few things that happened even since our Equity Shot midweek episode.
Yeah.
CEO Dara Khosrowshahi has now accepted the job. He was the CEO of Expedia, and he's gotten a lot of people seem to like him. He was lesser known, but
if you look at you're talking about a guy that was running a company that was going up directly against Google. Like, you guys remember when Google bought ITA way back in the day and got into flight search?
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
And this is a guy that still got the stock to like more than double in the past 5 years.
I think it was triple, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, he tripled it actually in the past 5 years, which is very impressive. And as I mentioned on the Equity Shot, I like that he has a great track record with treating his female employees well. The company is majority female, which I don't expect tech companies to be, but I'm impressed. It was 52% female. So, and then also, more importantly, the women are paid the same amount of money as men are for the same roles, dollar for dollar for every comparable role. So that's great because obviously Uber had a lot of problems with sexism. But going forward, he accepted the job. There was also a lawsuit this week, and it's moving to arbitration, the Benchmark lawsuit with Travis Kalanick, the former CEO who resigned in June. And so it's moving to arbitration. But there was one letter that everyone's been circulating. They sent it to us as well. I wrote about it on TechCrunch. But Shervin Pishavar, one of the early investors in Uber and a former board member, wrote something, which he now says he wrote at 4 a.m. last week to inspire his lawyers. And Alex, why don't you read some of the highlights from that?
Yeah, pro tip. As a writer, it's the only thing I've ever really done for money. Don't write at 4 a.m. Just general rule. But we pulled out one short sentence from this epic letter. Really, read the whole thing. Go find Katie's post and read it. But this specific bit of English just is beautiful. So without further ado, I give you Shervin via me. Their allegiance was met by this unholy alliance of perfidious greed developing rapidly into the audacity of vituperative, unparalleled, predatory rapacity. Now that, if you were curious, is not good writing. That's actually, in fact, awful writing. That's what happens when you're in eighth grade and you discover what a thesaurus is. And it comes out to be just really bombastic and over the top. And this letter doesn't just not do him justice. It really makes me doubt his ability to grasp the case honestly. This feels like someone that's like in the middle of a religious, like, you know, moment. And
is he just trying to put a stamp on this out of curiosity? Like, I mean, I've been following this saga for a long time and I still don't fully understand the benefit he has from getting so involved in this. Right?
Yeah. So, I mean, he is a shareholder. We'll give him that. He did intervene in the lawsuit. He filed a motion to intervene. He's been involved with Uber since the early days. He's clearly mad.
When he like shaved Uber into the back of his head. Is that with Shervin, right?
That was a better choice than writing this letter.
There's a photo of it somewhere.
There is. But I mean, to answer the question, I mean, no, I don't think there's a really great reason for this other than attention and trying to drive the company in the way that he thinks it should be. But I mean, now that there's a new CEO, who really cares what Shervin thinks? I don't think anyone does.
Well, in any case, read the whole letter.
You won't
be disappointed.
By the way, we're not done with Uber. There's still more.
Yeah,
there's two more things that happened this week. In other Uber news, the Department of Justice is investigating them for possible foreign bribes under what is called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Wait, you're saying that someone at Uber did something shady?
Possibly, allegedly, it is still being determined, but for whatever reason, they felt compelled to look into it. But this is the Wall Street Journal reporting that they're just taking preliminary steps right now. It's not clear if it's actually going to lead to a full-fledged investigation, but it wouldn't be the only company to have to deal with this. I guess Alcoa got in trouble for this. So, but yeah, it's definitely not surprising that Uber somehow has another legal situation potentially on its hands. One thing that is particularly interesting is the new CEO. He's already addressed employees. He was at a meeting with them this week, and he said that the IPO timing that we've been wondering about, we've talked about it many times in the show, is 18 to 36 months out. So I don't know if that's good or bad. On the one hand, he's finally put a timing, he's mentioned timing. I mean, Travis before was against IPOs and really said many times that he wasn't sure when or if they would IPO. But now we know more specifically when that's looking like to happen, although obviously it's subject to change, as he said. So it looks like 2019 or 2020 for this IPO.
I mean, it's also, I mean, when you, after this happened, I mean, I was going around asking people about Dara, and you talk to people, at least in Silicon Valley, and they're like, yeah, this guy knows what he's doing. And he's very, you know, he takes care of his employees. Right. And this is, you know, obviously this is what people are saying out here. Right. But, you know, Travis was delaying the IPO probably for, you know, a multitude of reasons, but by delaying the IPO, he's delaying a liquidation event for his employees, right?
Liquidity event.
Yeah. That's what I meant.
Liquidation is slightly different, but you're right.
Yeah, liquidity event. And so now it's, you know, you still have all these employees that are kind of twiddling their thumbs, paying taxes on the shares that they're exercising and all these other things. And now it's like, okay, you have a new CEO coming in who will sit down and say, don't worry, it's coming. It's coming.
And to that point, if you look at their adjusted net margin from the first quarter of this year, it was like -47%. And then in the most recent quarter, it was like -36%. So they have a credible ramp towards a less unprofitable company, which I think hints well that the 18 to 36 month timeframe isn't completely just fantasy. There actually is a ramp on the bottom line of this company towards something closer to zero. And that's encouraging. But I think
their revenue is growing, their losses are shrinking. So that stuff looks good for a future potential public company. But yeah, actually, we wanted to bring on Sam Angus, who's here. He's in the corporate group at Fenwick & West. He's a partner there. He works with big companies like Airbnb and GitHub, as I mentioned earlier. But he can't talk about his clients. What we can talk about, though, is, well, we were just talking about IPO timing and how some of these large companies delay their IPOs. They have these really high valuations and decide not to go public for a very long time, which is very different than it used to be. Why do you think that's happening?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's nice to be here with such a lively group. Well, the reason I think
that's a compliment.
Yes, that is a compliment. Yes, intended to be a compliment. Well, this is a trend that has really, you know, been going on for over a decade. This accelerated after the first internet bubble. I don't know if any of you in this room were around at that time, but it was
we were alive.
You were alive. It was a very robust and I would say speculative time for companies and. The majority of companies were going public at that time. It was quite easy to go public, highly speculative environment, and then, of course, the crash occurred. And then there were no public offerings for a period of 3 to 5 years in the tech sector. And I think that has continued somewhat for a couple reasons. One is after the bubble burst and a lot of the financial misdealings Enron and others, the government put in place Sarbox-Oxley, a set of regulations that made being a public company and going public somewhat more onerous. Venture capitalists cite it as one of the reasons why going public isn't as attractive. I don't know if that's true, if the companies can achieve the multiples and the market cap that public company investors are looking for. The other thing that happened is companies got much more capital efficient. It used to cost millions of dollars to start an e-commerce website, and now you can get one up and running pretty quickly for hundreds of thousands. And so companies now need less capital. And the other thing that happened is private company funding became much more accessible. You had the emergence of a set of angel class of investors that were professionalized. Before, it was doctors and lawyers and aunts and uncles who were providing money and maybe some tech entrepreneurs, but now you've got an entire ecosystem of seed funding funds, platforms, and individuals, and the whole seed market is professionalized. So these companies can get funding very easy. And then on top of that, you've had the access of later stage and growth capital, private growth capital, readily accessible. And VCs are willing to pay more for these companies. Growth capital funds, private equity, and even mutual funds are willing to fund. So the access of operating capital is there. So you don't need to go public to raise capital. And
which of those reasons is the most important? Sarbanes-Oxley? Is it the late stage capital? What's the key driver of that mix?
I would say it's both the ability of these companies to be extremely capital efficient, so they don't need to go public to raise money, and also the accessibility of late stage capital.
Yeah, well, also now I feel like you can just knock on SoftBank's door and say, hey, can I have $1 billion? And they'll give it to you.
Or 4 billion.
Yeah, or 10 or 20. Yeah. I don't know.
SoftBank is probably the ultimate outcome of this whole process where they've got a $100 billion fund and are investing, as you know, at a pretty rapid clip. So
rapid clip is an understatement. I mean, they're doing the WeWork deal is half secondary or something crazy that. Yeah. I mean, that blew my mind.
They'll own us all soon. Yeah, yeah. Here in this room.
Yeah.
I don't think SoftBank's gonna buy TechCrunch, guys. Yeah. Sorry.
Are you sure? Are you sure?
Personally, I just think they're taking over. But so there's a lot happening with SoftBank, and there's definitely been an availability of capital. But the problem is, if you delay your IPO too long, then a lot of the value gets. A lot of the growth is already happened before the time the company goes public. And so that's not really a good opportunity for new investors to invest in the stock market because the companies are either no longer growing at the same pace or in some cases not even really growing at all. And so we've had some recent tech IPOs that haven't done well. Mm-hmm. Some of them were for very different reasons, but some of them were because they waited too long. So what do you think about that?
I think that's an argument against going public. I do think there is an attitude among a class of private companies, especially founders who have come out of incubators and accelerators, that going public is not the thing you want to aspire to, at least it's not as much as you used to. And these founders have a specific sort of attitudinal aversion to going public. When capital is readily accessible, when and the emergence of a secondary market, the other issue you mentioned here is employees need to find liquidity. I mean, at some point, employees aren't getting liquid, and that can put pressure on these companies. But now you have the emergence of billion-dollar funds for secondary purchases, and it's quite a robust market. So literally, you have the conditions present where there may, these companies may be able to bypass going public for a very, very long time. The one thing I would point out is I think the metrics that public company investors are looking for has changed since the time of the bubbles, and it's a much tougher environment, especially for SaaS and enterprise software companies. They're held to a very strict, sort of set of operating metrics. And then you saw how Snapchat was punished brutally for not meeting expectations, even though these were more subjective expectations. Mm-hmm. So I think the public company investor is a different world when you're a public company. And I think a lot of private company CEOs and management know that once they go public, it's no longer they don't have the runway to think about innovating and operating their company. They now have to operate the business for public company shareholders on a quarterly by quarterly operating basis. And that can change the culture. It can change a lot of things about these companies.
Well, that's Twitter's constant complaint is why are you gauging us on MAUs? That's the wrong metric to gauge us on. We have all these other things and we're going to present this mystery chart about DAU growth, right? And I mean, I have to wonder if this aversion to going public, if public markets would actually kind of adjust the metrics that they look at. And obviously, we work with them because we have them, right? That's what we have to work with. That's what we have for our models, right? That's what we have for setting multiples and things like that. But, if some investor over at Morgan Stanley or whatever looks at Snap and is like, well, actually, let's look at engaged minutes instead of DAUs, right? Or let's think about, the amount of time that they spend on the app, and let's rethink our multiple by doing that. I mean, I feel like the other argument there is they handle thousands of public companies, right? So that's a lot of work. But I mean, is that something that you guys think that would you know, help encourage these guys to go public? Like, what if Uber were gauged on rides instead of margin, right?
That makes me want to vomit. I really, what I don't want to do is move closer to vanity metrics as a way to value shares of companies. I mean, I think your argument is that it's very hard to become mature enough to the point in which you don't want to lean on vanity metrics to uphold your public valuation, but boo-hoo. Get over yourself. This is business, not daycare. And so, no, I don't want to value Uber on rides or Twitter on active DAUs per minute squared. I want to talk about revenue. I want to talk about costs. I want to talk about, you know, net margin expansion. I mean, the things that matter in a business. These are companies, not vanity projects for Silicon Valley VCs.
Well, that's the thing. Is they're
still on their Patagonia vest.
Well, that's
Alex
the thing.
They think more like a public investor than a private investor.
But that's the thing. They're still being gauged on MAUs, right? So,
I think the other thing about these companies is what is brutal about them is you have to be extremely predictable about what your revenues, what your EBITDA is and your margins are. I mean, quarter after quarter after quarter. And that requires a lot of discipline. And, you know, can a company like Snapchat really be that predictable? I mean, it took a company like Facebook, right, a couple quarters to get it right. And that is an incredible company. I mean, that's a once in a 100-year company. And they have the business to support that type of predictability and those metrics. I think the answer is yes, it would be more receptive if they were gauged on those types of metrics. But public company investors, mutual funds are not interested in those metrics. They view those as higher risk. And also, I think a lot of the companies, when they go public, they're positioning themselves in the existing market based on the metrics that will be attractive to public company investors.
So I think the real problem here is these companies are getting overvalued. And so it makes them much harder to go public or get acquired even if you are overvalued. I think valuations, especially at the later stage, got fairly out of control in the past few years. And it would be embarrassing and cause a lot of other problems for employees and some of the later stage investors if they do what is now called a down round IPO. So I think that some of these companies that are delaying the IPO, it's partly because they feel like they have to grow into their valuation so that they have a market cap that's higher than their last private round. So that is something that should be interesting to watch. I think a lot of companies, or at least some people that work with companies, have learned their lesson. And so maybe the next company they work with, they're not going to let them get it overvalued again.
I love that new phrase, down round IPO. Is there an Investopedia page for that one, Justin?
Well, there have been a couple companies that have gone out below their last round. And what you also have seen in these later stage sort of private round offerings, these unicorn offerings, is sometimes these private equity investors and mutual fund investors will ask for downside protection in an IPO. So they will hedge against that. So that's absolutely a concern. I think
you're talking about all the ratchets and liquidation preferences and all that stuff.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Do you want to tell us just briefly what that is? So, I mean, we know, but for our listeners.
So for, you know, if a investor is investing in a company at a $60 billion valuation and there's usually some negotiation around whether that's the right valuation, and the PE investor is nervous that if they're going to pay that much and the company goes public, in which case they lose their liquidation preference, so they lose their downside protection when they go public, that they don't have any protection against selling out for less, you know, for having a security that's worth less than they invested in. So they will, there are various structures, but a common one is they will be issued more shares to bring them up to the valuation either at the IPO or some negotiated valuation. Like in the event that you go public, you guarantee us that you will have a market cap of $40 billion.
You're to blame for some of this, aren't you? You structure some of these deals.
No comment.
So when you see a ratchet, blame Sam. But basically, yeah, there's some investor protections that make it so that they don't lose money when they should. But in any case, there's, speaking of availability of capital, there's another way to raise funding now.
Alex is so ready for this.
ICOs. You may have heard of these initial coin offerings, Alex. I know you're eager to tell us what these are.
I feel like I need to stop making hand motions in the studio when we're recording this because I always get stuck with questions I didn't want to answer.
you know you want to answer.
ICOs are token sales for new crypto assets, and they're allowing people to take another crypto they own, like Ethereum or Bitcoin, and trade it for a future token that will have some utility. That sounds a bit arcane, but what's happening in the ICO market is people are throwing money at new ideas and new companies in a relatively unsafe way, I want to say.
Risky.
And people are often rolling over paper Ethereum profits from the Ethereum run in early 2017 into these things, and it has a lot of VCs scared because all of a sudden there is this huge river of available capital that's not controlled by them.
Wait, so
are they scared, though? Like, I mean, because if I were a startup and I had a choice between venture funding and ICO, I would definitely go with venture. I mean, this ICO thing, I'm risk averse. I don't like it. I think that the regulators are going to come after it. They already started to. I think this is for startups that don't have the VC option if it's sort of a last resort.
So signaling risk.
I'm probably an idiot here, but is this reserved exclusively for like blockchain technology companies that raise these ICOs?
People are being creative.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, you have other companies that are using it. What to me is intriguing is this is effectively like airline miles if they were tradable. So if you could buy airline miles, so if an airline could sell miles to you and then you could trade those miles to somebody else, that effectively is what an ICO is. And you have creative companies using them for goods and services. So for instance, you can have access to a pro open source code. You can have access to data. I think Kik just announced announced a big ICO offering where it's their own ICO.
It's their own currency.
Their own currency, Kikcoin, or whatever it is. Presumably is tradable for use on their platform. So it's a really, really interesting thing because in theory it's non-dilutive, right, from an equity holder's perspective. In theory, it's non-dilutive, and you get all this cash. In a way, it's kind of like a Kickstarter. If you could trade, you know, sort of your rights to a product.
But often there's a requirement to provide a service later on. So with Filecoin, if you buy into the presale, you're buying tokens that will later grant you access to its decentralized storage network.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. And hence the airline miles comparison about that you can use these later on. But I want to say in 2014. For April Fools, I wrote a piece entitled Introducing Crunchcoin. And I was therefore very early to the ICO thing because
prolific.
I do write too much, it's true. But I did this as a joke, and I feel like it's very 2017 that a prior joke becomes an actual reality that we have to discuss in a serious show. So that's my entire thing.
Yeah, well, so there are some proponents of ICOs who have reached out to me, and they're like, this is great because it's going to make it so much easier for ordinary people to invest in startups because— let's face it, there's a lot of regulation that makes it very difficult for non-accredited investors to invest in startups and potentially reap some very, very big benefits from that. Obviously, we've talked about some people who've made a lot of money from investing in startups on this show. And so there are some people that look at this and say, hey, I don't have the $250K that salary or $1 million in a bank needed to invest in startups, and they really want to. There have been some changes from the Jobs Act called Regulation A+ that allows for equity crowdfunding, but this is just one other way that's making it easier to invest in startups. But the problem is the reason there are those rules to begin with is most startups are risky investments. Most startups are very risky investments. And so even the most successful VCs in our industry fail most of the time for the early stage investors because there's just a lot of things that can go wrong in the early days of a startup. And so most likely these people are going to just lose a lot of money. It's possible they'll make it big, but it's also sort of like gambling.
I mean, I like gambling.
I know.
But you know what I don't do with my 401k? Gamble. I mean, I think this stuff's really cool. I mean, it's fun to see people inventing new ways to finance cool ideas. And fun at that level, I'm always in favor of stuff. But I am worried that I'm seeing people that I know in my personal life who are wildly unsophisticated investors who are tracking like the price of Ethereum on GDAX on their second monitor when they're at work. Like that level of like interest terrifies me, because still for Bitcoin, for Ethereum, and for all the major cryptocurrencies, their value is still very much predicated on potential upside instead of inherent utility right now. And that means the base level foundation that all these ICOs sit upon is very weak. And that's before you take on the risk of the ICOs not living up to their promises. And most of them are white papers with advisors. So they're essentially like jokes written on top of uncertainty that people are throwing money at. Not a good recipe for long-term stability.
Well, and also keep in mind that these ICOs are not investing in the companies per se. They don't have equity upside in the company. They're speculating on the value of their ICO. Will that right appreciate over time? So in theory, it's even more speculative than startup investing.
I agree with that.
Don't do it. Is what I'm saying.
I mean,
life finds a way.
I can't personally endorse it, but it is interesting to see people changing things up and giving other options. So if you are a startup that can't raise funding the traditional way, maybe you don't have the Silicon Valley connections. There is hope in theory because of ICOs. But I think that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in. Come back next week.
Hey, if you are a fan of Equity, there are more podcasts on the TechCrunch Network, including original content, a new show from Anthony Ha and Daryl Etherington, two of, if I may, the smartest and nicest people on the TC staff. And just for fun, here's a little taste of what's to come.
Hey, I'm Daryl Etherington.
And I'm Anthony Ha.
And we are the hosts of Original Content, a new TechCrunch podcast dedicated to everything original on the web.
And we are here right now to answer a few questions and tell you a little bit more about ourselves and about the podcast. So the first question, these were compiled by one of our producers, but they're great questions. Sum up your podcast in one sentence or a tagline, and the tagline would be Daryl loves trash TV.
Yeah, that's a good tagline. We don't actually talk that much about trash TV, though. So it only comes up tangentially, really. But I tried to do this the other day on the actual podcast, and it did not work out. It was like one of my sentences in my articles, which tend to be run-ons.
I would say, the actual tagline, which basically you used at the beginning, was just TechCrunch reviews all the cool content out there.
Yeah, that's about it. And I think that's a really good way to put it, because it's like it's kind of open-ended, which is a good thing.
At TechCrunch, we try to cover all these different streaming companies like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and Apple as it's investing more and more into this side. And, we talk about it mostly as from like a business perspective, but I think we wanted to just have a place where we could talk about whether this stuff was actually good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's become a huge part of our like day to day, more so than it used to be. And it's a thing where like, I've always been a fan of like TV and movies, I guess. I watch a lot of it. I think I consume more of it than maybe anyone on staff at TechCrunch. I'm challenging you. What do you think?
No, I think that's probably true. Once in a while I try to, read books, Daryl, but you're not into that kind of thing.
I gave up on that long ago. Leaves more time for MTV originals like
that's right.
The Real World and
right. Yeah. Well, what was it? You got an English degree in college?
Yeah, sure. So right. Too many books.
That just destroyed your love of literature right there.
Exactly. And now I love trash TV and trash TV only.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that leads into the next question, which is why is the podcast so long?
Oh. Is that just like a dig that he threw in at the end?
No, I think that's real. I think he means it.
Because there's so much out there. There's so much news. And I think we want to like be the best TechCrunch podcast in at least one regard. And the easiest one to shoot for is length of time.
That's right. It's, one of my favorite authors is Isaac Asimov, and he talks about the fact that at a certain point he realized he was never going to be, the best author in any one particular category, but maybe he could write the most books in the most categories, and that would be the thing that made him stand out. And so that's our goal, is to make just the longest podcast possible.
Yeah, and we're up to, I think the last one was like an hour 40, so see how long we can go. Tune in.
We'll do one day we'll do like a, or rather, you know, we'll do a full year episode at some point by the time we die.
Yeah, we have talked about doing like actual live stream commentaries, which would be pretty good if we like binged a whole season of something.
Right. It would be better if it was something bad, because I think we're just like increasingly becoming like delirious and insane.
Yeah. That'd if be it good. Was actual quality, it would probably not be that interesting. It would just be us going like, huh, yeah, hmm. And then being quiet and
enjoying. Oh, that, you'd be like, oh, that was good. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was good.
Yeah, that's not great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why
all of them?
No, we got two more.
Oh, what? I thought that was the last one. Oh, go.
No, why should... You were just so offended by why it's the podcast so long that you just blanked out on the rest of it. Why should anyone listen to this show? increasingly confrontational questions.
I think that it's a good way, for me at least, if I was not myself and was an other person listening to it, I would think the best part about it is that I can catch up really quickly, because this part is quick, or half of it is quick, I guess, on all the news, the big highlight news in streaming. It's sort of like a digest of what's coming, what's announced, what's exciting that week in original streaming content. And we do that for the first half of the show. So, I mean, that'd be my big draw, and then stay for the fun afterwards.
I mean, I would say the whole thing is fun, but also, sure. Yeah, slightly, I always joke about how long the episodes are, which we're working on, which maybe that won't always, you know, I think we're figuring out a lot of the format stuff, but fundamentally, there's just so much happening in that, in streaming right now, both in terms of news and just in terms of all these new shows, and our goal is to create a podcast where you can get completely caught up with everything you need to know for the week, whether that's what you should be watching, what are the latest deals, what are the latest products, and have that all in one place.
Yeah, and none of the stuff you don't need. We're a filter. We're a good filter.
Right. I mean, probably 50% of like us making dumb jokes that you don't care about. But aside from that, none of the stuff you don't need.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, final question. When and how can I listen to the show?
On the internet, using your devices, and there's actually a lot of ways you can listen if you really want to get into it. Apple Podcast is probably the most popular, or actually looking at the actual like numbers, a lot of people listen just in Chrome, which is totally viable because it's right up there on TechCrunch. With a player, you can listen on Twitter sometimes. It's any way you want. That's what we're all about. We're all about choice for you, the listener.
And we're currently publishing on Fridays, the idea that you can, you know, listen to the episode over the weekend or even before the weekend and know what to watch over the weekend. But again, I mean, this is a very new show, so we're figuring a lot of this stuff out, experimenting. So if you have feedback on episodes are too long, when we publish, any of that, feel free to shoot that our way too.
Yes. But also, back to how you listen, even if you don't listen to an Apple Podcast, just go subscribe there. Just go do it. It takes 2 seconds, and it helps us greatly.
Right. And if you're not listening, just play it in the background. Just, you know, once we get ads and stuff, let them run. You don't have to be consciously listening. It's fine.
I don't think that actually matters one way or another.
Oh, wait, no, but that's going to change, right? They're going to add analytics at some point.
In the future, they might have analytics on those, and then we need it to get that advertising cash, those big dollars.
That's right.
They pay for our Netflix subscriptions.
So yeah, listen to original content.
Yeah.
Find us on iTunes and anywhere else.
With your ears. That's the best way.
All right, I think we nailed it. Chris is going to like go crazy, try to cut this down to like a 30-second or 1-minute promo. But fuck it.
He wants it to be that short?
I have no idea. I mean, well, I have no idea.
We gave him a lot to work with. It's like when you're shooting B-roll, you want as much as you can
get. Right, exactly.
Great.
You can never have too much material.
Yeah, job right. Well done.